waited an eternity for this. It's over, Prime.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I am your host, Jay Hursko. Joining me tonight is fellow board member, James Gifford.
Hey, I see you got a toque on too, Jay.
It's going to be a long evening. And we also have joining us fellow coalition member, John Schneider. John, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. Can't wait.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Glad to have you. So the topic of this episode is going to be spiral dynamics for organizational change. So many of you may remember, it's probably about a year and a half ago, Troy Lightfoot did an episode with William Stridham where he went through the concept of spiral dynamics and the different levels of human evolutionary consciousness and how all these things lay together and you want to transcend and include and all that sort of stuff. Well, there's a whole different aspect to the idea of spiral dynamics, and it's really around change. Making people, making organizations ready for change, realizing if you're ready for change, realizing you're not ready for change, all the things that could potentially happen in the change, what are some of the first steps? And this book was written with human behavior in mind and human evolutionary consciousness in mind. However, there is a lot of common ground and close paradigms to what we see when we do organizational change and transformations. So what we're going to do, we're not going to go down the spiral rabbit hole, but we're going to talk more around the concept of change inside spiral dynamics, some of the concepts that come out of the book, and then we're going to talk about, do we see these things, do we not see these things, how they impacted us in our real life. And I don't think neither John nor James is as familiar with spiral as I am, so this is going to be a really, really exciting conversation, especially because I'm a good four beers deep. So let's get going. So, again, spiral dynamics, Claire Graves, Chris Cohen, Don Edward Beck, the emergent cyclical double helix model of the adult human biopsychosocial systems, right? So spiral dynamics, it's the people's evolutionary consciousness moving up and down the spiral. But how does this relate to change? So when it comes to change, think about, John, James, think about every transformation we've ever been part of. And if we think about it, the first thing you hear people say is everything is going to change. That's just an outright statement made by your leadership tier, made by your managers. We're going to change everything. And they're hoping to start a bandwagon effect, right? But in reality, it doesn't work that way because bureaucracies don't change. They take care of themselves. They're not worried about changing the flow of work. So when we think about organizational change, the first thing we need to think about is, are we in the right space to enact it? So in the book, they talk about there are four major conditions that can trigger, in the book, it's a life change, but I also think it meets what we're talking about with organizational change. So the four major conditions that show you're ready for a change are time, is where are you, where is your organization, where are you now and in relation to where you're headed, it's place, so what physical position are you are in relation to where you need or want to be. We talk about circumstance. So what is happening right now that will depend on our successful change, our survival, our existence? And lastly, the problems. So what problem has presented itself that requires a change? So James, I'm going to start with you. When you think about the last transformation you've just been through, or the transformation you're currently going through, which one of these four things was the impetus, or was it multiple? Was it time? Was it place? Was it problem? Or was it circumstance?
I'm going to go, some of it was a problem statement. You know, we were looking to reduce the lead time to value to our customers. You know, we, surprisingly enough, the healthcare software market is quite competitive. Pretty much the, you know, electronic health records business has, you know, just continuously grown, and it will continue to grow. So, you know, we needed to be competitive. We needed to reduce the lead time to value for our customers. And generally, we had a quality problem that we were trying to work through. So the need for better engineering practices. And, you know, as an organization, we needed some level of cultural mindset shift.
So it sounds like, James, you were basically hitting on all four. It started with a problem, but then there was a realization that the circumstances were ready, the time was right, you weren't in the right place. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, we hit all four. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting spot to be in because then, you know, how do you manage all this? How do you manage what, how much is too much change? What do you fix first? You know, the whole aspects of planning and managing that, you know, we've been kind of acting our way to new thinking and kind of doing the agile. And now it's, we're starting to really try to look at the cultural aspects of the company that are kind of, you know, we hit that kind of middle tier, like you're kind of hitting that rut. And it's like, you got to fix company culture now, or we're kind of stuck.
How about you, John, in your last transformation, the one that's most damaging and recent in your mind, did these four scenarios fit time, place, problem, circumstance? Was it a combo of one or two? Was it one more than the others? Tell us.
I think it's similar to James. I mean, it started with a leader or several leaders aligning around, hey, we're not doing this thing at the right time, at the right place, at the right speed, and figuring that, okay, this must be an entryway to start solving that. But you're right, that then bled to, is this the right circumstances, and so on. So it did kind of go that same route. And the interesting thing about that problem statement, though, is if you have a good foundational problem statement, then yeah, the rest follows, and then your transformation kind of sets up. But unfortunately, the problem statement was not the company problem statement. It was a certain individual's problem statement. So didn't really kick off the right way. And it was more of a selfish transformational need in a certain department area. So that's what made it more complex. So instead of having a CEO or executive at the top saying it, it was more of a very senior VP that still needed other VPs to make it successful. So.
Interesting. So it started out as almost a pet project, and then it slowly metastasized from there. So that's actually a great segue, because one of the next concepts they talk about in the book is, are you ready for a change? And the idea is, there are conditions that need to be present for a change to even be introduced, not successful, unsuccessful. There needs to be certain conditions that are ready. And the conditions they talk through is, the first one is potential for change. Is there a potential there? That dovetails into solutions. So are there solutions available for current problems that you could realize by going through a change? The next one is dissonance. So is there something in the current system that seems out of whack that maybe a change could fix? Are there barriers? So are there barriers identified of things that need to, for the change, that can be overcome? Also, is there insight? So are there probable causes and viable alternatives for what you're currently going through, whatever's ailing you? And then lastly, it's consolidation. Is there an opportunity to consolidate and gather support behind the change? And I'm going to go back to you, John, because your example, I think, based upon what you just said, I think maybe a couple of these were missing. So in your experience, which were the ones that, I mean, regardless of where you ended up, when it first started, which were the ones that really weren't there, and what was the result?
It's always easy to say they all apply, but I think the dissidence and the consolidation for sure. I mean, in there were so many barriers, whether it was role mm-hmm. alignment or just alignment on the problem and statement itself. One of the major things in transformations is, like, we all understand that we want to do this, but do we all go to the same drumbeat of why we're doing it, or do we have the same mission behind that? And that's where the consolidation comes, where they could not gather the change as one unit because they all had misaligned expectations, right? This person was trying to get speed. This person was just trying to get feedback loops. This person was trying to actually improve people. And so right off the bat, they all had their own selfish goals that weren't aligned. So it just, and yeah, there were some insights and some other things they wanted to get out of the company as well. But I feel like if you tackle them all at the same time and it's not prioritized, then you just never make traction. So that was definitely a big part of it.
How about you, James? Which one of these comes to mind? Were they all there? Were you lucky?
So it's kind of interesting. We started out, you know, we started out from the top. Leadership 100% bought in. If they, you know, and they, as an executive leadership team, you know, from the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as I like to sometimes refer to them, there was a general alignment in the organization around, at the senior leadership level, this is what we're doing, this is how we're going to go about it, here's the plan. They were bought in 100%, lock, stock, smoke and barrels, propagated it down through the organization of why, the value statement across the, you know, the disciplines. So we had the support, the drumming of the beat of why, the what's in it for them, the why we're doing this, why we need it as a company. And then we're kind of still now stuck, though, somewhere in the middle, where middle managers are scared. They don't know what their world looks like in this. You're acting me to be, you're now asking me to be a coach and mentor to people and not a firefighter. You know, I don't have those skills. I made my bread and butter solving problems for, you know, the people that that report to me. Even though we started out with the majority of our organization had already been like 2 years into matrix management. So for a company to make a leap from matrix management product, you know, project management kind of style to make a leap to self-autonomous, you know, empowered teams shouldn't have been a monumental leap. Boy, were we wrong.
Man, if we all of us had a dollar for every time we've had to say, boy, were we wrong about a supposition, we'd all be rich. So along with the conditions being ready for change and all the right scenarios and the impetus, one of the things that they talk about in the book is change typically follows frustration. So the reason why organizations change is because they get frustrated. And then you reach almost another, if this was like the game of life and it was a board game, here would be another decision point, right? Where you've met the conditions for the change, right? There's a reason that all the conditions are there and you're presented with that situation. At this point, you really have three options as far as Spiral Dynamics proclaims. The first option is you could just walk away. And the question to ask yourself is, are you fighting entrenched interests that have more power than you? Are the conditions for change not present? Are the systems closed irrevocably? Or do you not have the power to support the change? So John, that's a bit interesting for your first example where you had one guy waving the banner and then next thing you know, everything came in behind it. The second option when it comes to running a change and deciding, do we go or do we stay? Do you need to reframe the conditions, right? So let's look at the priorities and let's reassemble them into something that's maybe more feasible. And the one-liner that was in the book around this part that I thought was fascinating is get people ready for new ideas, but also get new ideas ready for people. So it prescribes that it's not just an imposition or an invitation. It's more of an inspiration. Hey, get everybody right in the right mindset so they're ready to take the transformation. And then they talk a lot about using information radiators and whatnot. The third option is if you're presented with this change and you think things are ready, instead of walking away, instead of reframing the conditions to do the change, you connect the new ideas with the pre-existing systems. So, and Gifford, I'm gonna start with you because I want to ask about this. You know, conceptually, we and most practitioners talk about this all the time. Most companies are a little bit more agile than they think they are, right? So in this option, you want to connect these new agile ideas. I mean, aside from, you know, participatory budgeting and, you know, all that stuff, lean business cases, you want to connect these new ideas to their current system, their current structure. And then to almost steal a Dave Snowden activity, you start probing to see which will correlate and which resonate. And then you use the similarities and overlap to provide people with confidence that the change is going to work. So let's talk about yours, James. When you started introducing these ideas, I'm assuming the idea of iterative delivery, faster time to market, all that sort of stuff was already there. How did you map that world? Was it really, we do things this way, now we're going to do things the same but different? Or was it totally reframing the narrative?
See, and that's, you know, I unfortunately don't have the full context of how it happened because I came in about a year into the transformation. So they had already had the consultant in there. I was coming in really to kind of start the transition to transitioning out the consultants and leaving behind the team of internal change agents and the agile coaching team. But if I, you know, if I heard the stories correctly, it was, we're going to Scrum. You know, we already do iterative development, but we still do, in the beginning, they did big upfront planning. So to kind of prep teams to get them kind of working in a different way and slowly transition the teams into owning refining work, we used the notion of a refining team. So you almost had staged things where you had this team of people that were getting stuff ready, the team would then build and then move on. And then slowly but surely we whittled away at the idea of this refinement team. And then the teams are like, well, this is just a waste of time. We're spending time talking about something already, and I want to weigh in on that. And they're like, well, you know what? We could just kind of phase that team out and you guys could all just talk to the product owner and the business people and write the stories together. Well, that just is a much more logical way to do our business. So let's just do that. Like, so we had to put a stop, you know, we put something in there that helped them feel comfortable. And then after a while they realized it was stupid and they're like, what can we do to get rid of this? And I'm like, great. It's, you're ready for the next thing. So let's introduce it to you, because now you hate what we've already put in. And now, you know, it's not uncommonplace for, you know, people to, you know, just want to work together in more iterative ways.
Interesting. Kind of ways. So you took a couple of approaches there and it all just sort of flattened out at the end.
Yeah. I mean, we had a, you know, we needed the need to keep our integration teams. So we had a whole bunch of testing people that did automation after the fact. So instead, you know, all your end-to-end integration testing, all that stuff the team should be writing. We had a downstream team that, you know, basically everybody built it, the product owner accepted it, it went to this other team, they hammered on it some more, wrote the automated testing. Eventually they're like, this is dumb, we should just be doing this in the sprint. And so then we phased it out. So we literally had almost we were doing some funky phase gate scrum with a Kanban in between the middle, you know, Kanban on one end, a Kanban on the other end with scrum smashed in the middle. And over time they're like, this is stupid. This is really stupid. I'm wasting all this time talking to this integration guy about what the requirements were. There's a disconnect. And then all of a sudden there was pain. There was kind of friction. It got them doing it. Mm. It got them moving forward. They felt pain. They said that, you know, they came to the realization that what we were doing was stupid. And then they were ready for the conversation about where we should go.
Nice. How about you, John? Connecting the current system to the new ideas, or was it more of let's just completely reframe the whole thing? Because obviously you didn't just walk away.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of both. So I'll just walk through it and you'll understand. But basically, since, like I said, there was a senior representative that kind of drove it, right? So we didn't have leadership buy-in as a whole. So the strategic intent with that is, well, we need to get some pockets and wins with our teams to show and model so leaders get bought in. And I was the only coach. Hundreds of people, they didn't want to invest a lot, and they just said, make magic, you got a year. And the whole point was, people either hear the word agile and are fearful and hate it, or they hear the word agile and they just go, I'll try it. But like, that's what I walked into. So starting with that, we went to the teams, and basically the secret sauce that I usually like to do, especially with people that have heavy legacy system backgrounds, SAP backgrounds, and very structured technical backgrounds like that, use terms they're familiar with and kind of don't say agile terms. So you kind of educate them on what you want to do without actually using the taxonomy of agile. And, you know, they secretly own it, they start doing it. And then by the time you actually explain, hey, you know, you're just doing Scrum or you're just doing this, they're like, oh, darn, you got me. So that was basically what we did, is we got a bunch of teams and I was like, hey, why don't we take this, you know, step-by-step waterfall you're doing, let's do it in a chunk here and we'll milestone a little differently, and basically used all their terms and just shortened everything. And I'm like, all right, after 2 months, after they started doing it for a while, I was like, okay, this is called Kanban. So it's like, you know, you usually do it in the reverse, right? You train them, they do it, they did it. And then they realized, right. He already got us. And the biggest part with that was also fighting the leadership along the way, where they said, you know, we're adamant we have to do this 18-month plan. We won't get value for 13 months. You know, they have to do upfront design for 6 months and discovery, blah, blah, blah. So fighting them along the way, that single senior VP was the only reason we were able to continue to make traction. But I do think that using those conditions of muscle memory of what they knew, taxonomy and just their processes, and aligning that terminology and working them through that, made it easier for them to eventually just get bought in and start doing it. And that worked at the leadership level too.
And that's fantastic, because if you think about what the biggest struggles we have with our transformations, it's typically, you know, teaching an old dog new tricks, where you're really not teaching an old dog new trick. You're reminding them of a trick that they actually know. It's right. Just got a different badging and there's a cert and a placemat attached to it. But moving along, that's the next episode. We'll go down that rabbit hole.
It goes back to respect what you do today and agree to continuously improve.
Understand before being understood. Yep.
Yep. Perfect. So one of the concepts that they introduced in the book, which I thought was super, super fascinating, was the idea of how change journeys progress, and they boil it down to, it really comes down to a repeatable set of steps. The first step is the alpha fit, and what he means by the alpha fit is that's where you are today, that's your current world. The next step is what is called the beta condition, which is where that alpha fit starts to come apart. It's where people start realizing that something is wrong, a change is needed. It goes back to those four things. Is it time? Is it problem? Is it current state? Is it circumstance? That's where people start realizing that our current alpha is no longer relevant to us. We need to change. And this is where it gets interesting, because then organizations and people typically go down one of two paths. They go through a reform path, which is considered evolutionary change, which is they say, okay, we're going to evolve into the state that we want to be in, minus all the chaos and the combat and the conflict, right? This is pie in the sky transformation. The other side of that, is which I think is more real, is what's called the revolt, which is revolutionary change. And this is where things hit that typical J curve. And in the bottom of the J curve, they call the J curve the gamma trap, right? We've done alpha, we've done beta, now we've done the gamma trap. And this is where everybody's running around screaming, everything is falling apart, we have all these barriers, this is never going to work, blah, 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 blah. And then eventually, you know, two things happen. It either dies in the vine, and you go back to a alpha fit that's really more of a beta condition, but nobody wants to do anything about it because they're not empowered or they don't have the influence, or they surge past it. They do what's called the delta surge, and they surge into the new alpha, which again is the ultimate end state, the ideal place of where we want to be. So when you look at evolutionary change, that's where we're taking the happy path and we're saying, okay, we're going to be patient and calm and go through this together. The revolutionary change is, oh my God, the roof is on fire. The roof is on fire. And just as a yes or no answer, James, have you ever been in a transformation where the company took the evolutionary change, the reform, and not the revolutionary change, which is the revolt?
So, I mean, we go through spits and spurts of revolutionary versus evolutionary. Because I mean, we try to iteratively evolve the methodology we do. We're trying to build we have an enterprise with 9 different locations that is literally, it's a bunch of acquisitions. So you have a bunch of different companies, different things like that. So we're always continuously evolving the methodology. And we do it in test cycle, the various ways of rolling it out across products. So we never, the only people that really ever see the change are generally the products that are willing to experiment. We use those guys as the test beds. We validate process changes in there. We have success behind it before it ever goes to the broader audience. So so there are success stories. There are people saying this was great. Oh, hey, we hated this. Okay, well, we can fix that before anybody else sees it. So we always start out with a cycle of small wins, take it to the next product, test it again, come back, realign, and then go for larger rollout. So we generally never really hit a condition of revolutionary. I want to say large financial institution in Delaware that wanted to do components.
Yeah. 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 We've been down that. Definitely been in the revolutionary.
So where we had the revolutionary, we've taken it to a more of an approach where evolutionary is the norm, and we have our safe path to kind of get to evolutionary change. And we still have people that don't want to adopt it and argue with you and fight. But, you know, most of those folks are the people that, you know, there are laggards. And in all honesty, if I had my magic wand, I'd Noah's Ark that place and, load all the willing onto the boat and let the flood take the rest away. But, you know, you got to find your change patterns and what works for your company. And we find that using an evolutionary method, building successful wins before a broader rollout tends to lead to success.
And I'm going to skip over your horrible pun of we have a safe path to success. There's a rim shot and a symbol there, but I'm not going to go down that one. John, how about you? So have you been part of one that's been evolutionary? Have you been part of one that's been revolutionary? What's been your experience?
I think it's definitely a mix, like James, but I think more of the revolutionary side has definitely been more like specific team by team or program by program scenarios. I don't think there's ever been like a massive leadership revolutionary one. It's got close, but not to that extent. And then the evolution pieces, it's similar to what James said once again, where teams usually that had that type of success had other teams to reference or experiment or maybe try things before they actually saw it. So try it before you buy it kind of thing. And they basically had everything spoon fed to the point where it was almost like super high confidence going into it. Then you had the experimental teams that actually thought revolutionary technically wasn't really a bad thing. They were kind of willing to accept those really down spurts in the effort of really trying to innovate and push. But yeah, I thought it was pretty amusing seeing some of the team members like, you know, come on board and try to adopt things. And all of a sudden that curve starts going down and down. And as they're trying to like get through the iterative process and incremental, and they're going through everything and they're starting to get really frustrated and they're starting to throw in the towel, that curve is right at the bottom of that J. It's really frustrating. All of a sudden some business person comes to him and says, "Hey, I really like that you gave this to me really quickly, by the way, and I can't wait to see more." And that little glimmer the business just gave shoots it right back up.
The hockey stick. Yep. Perfect. So when we're going through these changes, one of the things the book talks about, which I thought was really insightful because we don't really have many instances of someone putting these ideas to paper, and what we do is the idea of during a change, you're going to bounce around. And the organization is going to go in multiple directions, almost like a bird caught in the house looking for the open window. And when I read through these, I thought it was really, really insightful, because if you think about it, most I can say with pretty certainty that most of the transformations I've been part of have taken at least two or four of these stages, right? So the first stage is you fine-tune your org. So we keep the current state. We don't really change much. We don't change our thinking. We don't change our assumption. We're just, we're going to dip our toes into the agile thing. The second stage is the expand out, where you're going to take your current state, but you're going to elaborate on it. So you're going to include some new ideas like Scrum. Every time I hear that word, I think of the episode from Silicon Valley and Jared says it, and I want to, we're going to do Scrum with the Post-its. So this is the way it's termed in the book, is it's enrichment with minor advancement. So you've tried to fine tune your org. You've tried to expand a little bit. Now this is where things start getting painful. So the next step after that is what's called the stretch down, which is this is where you talk the talk without walking the walk. So this is our idea of taco agile, right? So new titles, new ceremonies, new buzzwords, but you're still not getting wholesale change. Once you stretch down, then you start stretching up. And this is where you're placating your current environment. You're changing the appearances, the idea of a fresh coat of paint. So you're kind of sort of dipping your toes into the new ways, but it's regression is still very, very likely because people still have that general feeling that it feels risky, right? And then this is where things take that revolt or reform. You either hit the revolt where someone finally raises up their hand and says, "Look, we've reached the bottom. The only way out is through. Let's go. Fundamental change is demanded. No compromise. Change it. Destroy it." This is where all your corporate antibodies, I know Simon Wardley talks about that all the time. This is where they come into play, where they start coming out of the woodwork, trying to assault the virus here. And then there's the reform, which is your upshift, which is where people are consciously trying to change. They see the barriers, they avoid them. It's peaceful. It's, to James's point, evolutionary. And then you have a slight regression, but then there's a massive forward shift. And then the last one, of course, which I don't think I've ever seen, maybe my current gig gets maybe a little close to it, which is the quantum vertical, which is massive, simultaneous change from all different levels, all different places. Everything is moving at once. Everybody's drinking the Kool-Aid and they're off to the races. So, John, I'm going to start with you. So which one of these resonated with you most as I was reading them off based upon your past experiences? Can you think of one where you've done the whole stretch down, stretch up, where you put the perfume on the pig? Can you think of one where they kind of placated it? Like which one resonates folks in your front of your brain?
You're bringing back some weird flashbacks on whole, like, what do we call them? Product owner, product manager, like all that stuff. Like, so let's avoid that. But yeah, we definitely have done that and said like, here's your role and here's your title. And then like, here's your 2-day training. And it's like, all right, have at it. And then, you know, they obviously like just start floundering and trying to figure things out and frantically Googling articles on what their role is supposed to be. So there's definitely been a lot of that. And then of course they stretch up, they really do try. And then when there's no coaching or leadership help and all that, yeah, they start to regress, and that's where the coach has to keep stepping in. So that's painful, but very common. That is a lot of what I saw, especially being a single coach and hundreds of people and trying to help them. It was very common of that to happen. The interesting thing about the quantum vertical you mentioned, though, is we did have a group where we did have a senior leader that said, look, we need to launch an e-commerce site, which always requires almost every department in the company to be successful. You're talking supply chain, accounting, merchandising, the dev team, like every single facet. And in order for them to even kickstart a problem statement aligned to a cadence of weekly outcomes that showed value, they had to get every single senior leader in the room and say, that's our problem statement. Here's our goal. Do you agree? Wow. And it took 4 days of 12-hour sessions every day to finally get them aligned. But that was kind of our way to sort. That's the closest quantum vertical I can think of.
But you said, it sounds like you set a North Star. You had everybody in the room agreeing that this is the direction, this is the new alpha we want to go towards.
And it did make the team go super fast, because when blockers or issues or priorities in the company came up, every leader was like, yep, that's important. We know the outcome. And it was like a very quick decision.
You're definitely creating people who are listening, John, who are jealous of you because they don't have that luxury, right? They're still screaming and yelling about, do I call it a product owner or a product manager, you know?
That's true.
How about you, Gifford? I know you and I have been in some of the same trenches where there's been the reluctance, there's been the shift up or down where we put the perfume on the pig. Which one of these resonated with you?
I like the easiest way. No. I mean, we've seen it all. You end up in an organization and you got to do the best you can with what you got. I mean, you know, it's frustrating to, when you're working at a company, I'm just fumbling over myself because I'm, you know, just incessant frustration. I mean, the whole like business product owner versus a technical product owner, and they're the proxy. And it's like, guys, look, really, we're playing telephone. We're playing telephone here. Can you just this guy is not going to give us the support we need doing this job 50% off the side of his desk. Like, this is a real role. Mm-hmm. Like, these are real things that we fight. The idea of you, like, even bringing in stuff like, hey, you guys don't unit test at all. Can we just get unit testing going? Like, just they're like, when you run into some of this stuff, it's just like, I don't know how you guys have been running as a company and make money, but good for you. Like, good for you making money. Like, I'm glad that you think the component teams are the greatest way to quality in building software, but we still can't integrate the shit. And your product lead time is, you know, what could have been built by a team in 2 weeks is now 12 weeks, and we've overrun your $100 million IT budget by $200 million, and we only delivered a quarter of what you asked for. Jay, you were there.
Yeah, man, you know how much therapy it took to unwind some of that stuff, and you're just bringing it all just right back, throwing it right on the table.
But, like, that's the stuff you walk into. These were people that weren't ready for change at all. Mm-hmm. They didn't get it. They didn't want to get it. They had their old PMI head on. And they're like, we can manage it all with program management and make it all magical.
Yeah, not a good look. So, gentlemen, the last aspect of the book, which honestly I'm suggesting to all our listeners read it. It's a bit heavy, but it's a great read. One of the last aspects they touch on that I would like to talk about here is the idea of leadership from the second tier. So if you're familiar with Spiral Dynamics and you've listened to that previous episode, I'll put a link in the show notes. There's the idea of first tier versus second tier thinking. Second tier is the more integral, like transformative, evolutionary thinking. And they talk a lot about leadership from that second tier. So what are leaders that lead from that place for a successful change? What are the types of attributes or behaviors that they should embrace or represent or resemble? A couple of things here which are going to sound familiar to a lot of you. The first one is think in terms of open and not closed. So anything is possible. Change is transitory. This is that growth versus fixed mindset that we all blather on about. There's an idea here which I thought was impressive, working with the company's natural rhythms. There are inherent flows in the organization, so recognize them and use them to your benefit. Another idea is for leaders, the prime directive is the overall health, which is, we talk about system optimization. You know, less class, beat it into my head for 3 days. Once you see local optimization, you can't unsee it. Optimize for the whole, which may mean a suboptimization of parts. There's another term here for leaders in the Spire world, which is being comfortable with many worlds. So be malleable to change yourself to meet the environment that you're attempting to change. So this is that. This is very important for a lot of us who have to, like James said, you know, you come into an engagement and you have no idea what's going on. And then it's like, well, shit, I got to really change my thinking here. Another aspect of a second tier leader is using whatever's there for you that will work. Resources, skills, strategy. The quote from the book is, nothing from the past is thrown out. Conversely, nothing from the future is rejected. So it's almost fixed versus growth. Again, go in with that open mind. Use whatever works to get yourself successful. And the last thing is what I think is true systems thinking, with a little bit of Ken Wilber's integral thrown in. Think systemically and solve integrally. So always consider the big system, big picture, and combine system aspects to create an integral solution. And I'm gonna start with you, John, and I'm gonna go to you, James. We know that transformations are typically done from the bottom up. Much as how we'd like to do, it's top down, bottom up, same time. It's typically done from the bottom up. So what approaches have you seen work in your transformation history closet, so to speak, where you've actually gotten leaders onto this circuit and started to help introduce them to these types of ideas and ways of thinking in order to make them successful? Have you seen it work in the past?
So this is going to sound a little corny, but it's like, you know, do the Gemba walk and really like be one with your people, like really understand what's going on and empathize. Cause sometimes they're at a level that's so high level strategic that your team either doesn't care, you know, it doesn't impact them ever. And there's so many downstream variables and, you know, whisper down the lanes to the decision you make that sometimes it doesn't even change their day-to-day job. So one time we actually did have to integrate them where, that what you just listed off, I mean, the many worlds is a big, huge thing where as a leader in the transformation space, where I had to work with HR, finance, engineering groups of mechanical, and then software development, like the approach was never the same. And sometimes I was so ignorant and dumb in this space where I literally just had to get educated for a while before I could even help them. And I feel like leaders need to be very, have some more humility in that and really start to understand their teams. And now that's the extreme version, where if you want teams to get bought in and make change quick bottom up, that's what I would say. But a lot of organizations, it's very hard to do that and difficult, where the leaders, like, it's too big of a team, right? We're talking massive size. Yeah. So in my area, that might be possible. But if you're talking 500,000, 10,000 people, okay, now you have to lean on your managers and leaders, right? And that's where it starts to get a little complicated. So yeah, the many worlds is definitely something that's big, but yeah, open-minded, right? I mean, just you have to keep trying to push.
Yeah, and I think especially when I know a lot of our listeners work in enterprise environments like you were just talking about, where the scale is almost too big to conceptualize. This is where, and I've seen it personally, this is where transformation sometimes like sputter and start losing some gas, is you need to impart this wisdom on someone who's so up on the strategic totem pole that it's almost a different type of oxygen, like to quote Layer Cake, right? It's a completely different way of breathing and living.
Yeah, and that's why, so in the, I say small, but we're still talking 500,000 people, like use what you have available to you. Like, oh, we don't have a product owner. Like, well, what can you do? Oh, we don't have this role. Well, what can you do? And optimizing that stuff that for the resources, skills, and strategy is definitely key. But yeah, in the super large organizations, what can you optimize? I mean, that's always the approach, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, usually the go-to.
How about you, James? What luck have you had with imparting leaders with this type of thinking, and how do you go about introducing these concepts to someone who may have, you know, gotten their Mercedes and their McMansion in Villanova doing the exact antithesis of what we're talking about here?
Well, first of all, if you're listening to this show and going, what the fuck is systems thinking? Go read The Fifth Discipline and call us back. if you're a leader, go read the. If you're a leader and you're listening to this podcast and you haven't read The Fifth Discipline, go read it now. Understand value streams. We had Karen on the show many, many moons ago. That's Jay's first solo. Yay, Jay. We can put some show. We can put links to this in show notes. I mean, as leaders, you always have to keep an eye on the prize and understand the heartbeat of your organization. And it comes back to, you know, something that will make or break a change is the feedback loops and information coming back up and, you know, trusted advisors of open thinking individuals that can help leaders make those decisions and read the, you know, the landscape. You know, we funnel in a lot of data from all of the different teams on the Lean Ad, you know, that are on our Agile transformation, because we're still a bimodal IT shop. But we have a pulse on, like, what's going on, where teams are struggling, what are things that are common challenges across products, and then strategically trying to move people towards a direction that solves the systemic issues in the organization. Because just because they're not, you know, we have, you know, roughly 30 some different products in the family of products. Ironically, it doesn't matter what location you're in, they roughly all suffer from similar kind of problems that need addressed. And they're all in different states of their Agile transfer, you know, journey, things like that. But being able to find those data, commonize, you know, some of this stuff, and I'm, you know, giving the secret sauce to some of the remote coaching stuff. But, you know, I need leaders with an open mind that are willing to listen to data and generally understand systems thinking, the ideas around value stream mapping, different things like that. And, you know, I sat down with a leader and tried to explain some of this spiral dynamic stuff. And he looked at it and he's like, Gifford, this color shit is just foofy nonsense. And I'm like, he's like, but now that I read about it, I kind of get it in our organization. And, he, you know, I gave him where our organization was after he told me what it was, and it lined up correctly. But it was, you know, understanding the cost of some of this stuff. Change is expensive. Getting people to think differently is expensive. So I need a lead.
Change is expensive. That's going on your tombstone there, Gifford.
Well, and so I need leaders to be able to be fiscally minded and go, mm-hmm. Holy crap, the mass size of this change is going to be so expensive that it's not even practical to do it.
Right. Right. Good point. Really. Change is expensive. That's going to be the pull quote from this episode. So I know we're quickly at time. So I want to wrap us up real quickly. So John, thank you for joining us. I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again, maybe on the next episode. James, once again, thank you. On behalf of James and myself, I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in again. If you enjoyed the episode, please give us a review or a rating. Leave us a comment, iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast, Podbean, Podbros, whatever your podcasting platform of choice is, it does help others find us. And remind everybody, we have a coalition message board. We have a Discord server. We're all over Twitter. There's plenty of places you can find us and engage in the conversation. The door is always open. We'd really like to hear what you think. This is one of those weird topics that Troy sends me down this rabbit hole, and then he has to, you know, take a nap, and then I'm stuck hosting. So once again, I want to thank all, James and John. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. And this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.
Wash your hands.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.